carved out success by their own definition. I'm David Cadavy, best-selling author and entrepreneur. Today's guest is Andrew Johnson, who creates the Relax app. I've been a huge fan of Andrew's work since a reader recommended the Relax app to me about 2 years ago. Andrew has a whole empire of apps with guided recordings that help people not only relax, but quit smoking, reduce anxiety, lose weight, or build confidence, amongst many other things. His apps have been downloaded more than 10 million times. And I have literally found Andrew's apps to be life-changing for me, but I've also been fascinated by these apps as a business. They seem so simple. But behind Andrew's apps is more than 20 years as a hypnotherapist, and in this interview, I'll be digging into how he got into such an unusual career, what are some of the misunderstandings about hypnosis, and how did he create his own luck to have the best-selling self-help recordings on the Apple and Android app stores. We'll also find out why he lights a candle before he does his work. If you try Andrew's app, which you can check out at cadavy.net/relax or in the show notes, here's a tip. Try to use a device that you don't get notifications on. I used to use my iPhone to listen to Relax, then I realized that was a bit like trying to take a nap in my kitchen. I have an iPad on which I don't allow notifications, so it's reserved for things like Relax. At the very least, put your device in airplane mode. Just a quick update on last week's call for iTunes ratings. It turns out getting from 53 to 75 was probably a taller order than I had expected. Likely those of you who were motivated to rate did so a long time ago. We did get one more rating, which doesn't sound like much, but every single one helps. If you just weren't able to get it onto your schedule, it's never too little and it's not too late. It was also great to see more of you sharing the show on social media, which is a huge help, so thank you for that. I commissioned a transcription of our most popular show, the first one with Jason Fried, so I've added that to the show notes, that transcription. I also made a YouTube version of that episode, and these efforts likely motivated Jason to tweet the episode a couple of times to his 160,000 plus followers, which created a nice spike in listens for the show. If you keep supporting our sponsors, it will go a long way towards more efforts like getting transcripts and getting the show onto other platforms. So, thanks as always for your support, and for rating, reviewing, subscribing, and sharing. Before we get started in this interview, how would you like to be a part of a future show? I've been doing a lot of research lately on the topic of digital distraction, and I'm planning a conversation, not an interview, but a conversation with Nir Eyal, who is author of the book Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products. Nir and I are both in the business of distraction, me as a former designer and someone who relies upon your attention to keep my business running, and Nir as someone who teaches the methods that could be used to distract people. And Nir and I are both concerned about the effects this can have on individuals and on society as a whole, so we'd love to hear from you before we record our conversation. The conversation is tentatively titled, Is Silicon Valley Leading Us Into the Robot Apocalypse? So to start off, how has distraction affected you and what have you done about it? Email me at david@cadavy.net or for a chance to be on the show, email an audio file of you speaking. Feel free to mention your name and your preferred social media presence. Okay, here's the show. This episode is brought to you by Treehouse. Take your career to the next level and learn from over 1,000 videos created by expert teachers on web design, coding, business, and much more. Claim your free 14-day free trial at cadavy.net/treehouse. You'll be supporting the show. I'm here with Andrew Johnson, who creates the Relax app. And Andrew, I love the Relax app. I use it all the time. So my first question is, as a hypnotherapist, is there a risk, since I use the Relax app so much, is there a risk of me falling asleep during this interview?
No, unless I go into hypno mode, which is my superpower.
Oh, maybe we can
No,
get to that actually.
we could get to that, but no, the relaxation that's part of the hypnotherapy is very slow and very gentle, and in a one-to-one session, in person or even on Skype, I've never in my entire career had anyone fall asleep ever.
Oh, wow.
Now, people fall asleep with the apps and the MP3s, but never in a one-to-one session.
Yeah, I mean, I sometimes use the app to fall asleep,
Sure.
but then there's, of course, there's the wake setting, which is what I usually use, and I'll use it instead of taking a nap, because if I were to take 24 minutes out of my day and decide I'm going to take a nap, I would end up just being frustrated because in that 24 minutes, I'm not likely to be able to fall asleep. But 24 minutes of using your relaxation app, I end up feeling refreshed, even if I don't fall asleep.
Yeah, it's a different level from trying to do it yourself. The one of the difficulties with sleep and relaxation and meditation is that if you try to do it consciously, you block it.
Yeah.
And therefore, when you're trying to take a nap or trying to fall asleep or trying to relax, most people end up frustrated. It's one of the big problems that people have.
Right. And I mean, the first time that I used, when I was first using the Relax app, I think I had like so much tension in my jaw that I was conscious of it, but my mouth, my jaw was kind of like flapping open and closed just because it was relaxing those jaw muscles
Sure.
so much. Is that something that happens often?
Well, anything that, if you hold tension in any area of your body for a long period of time, if you relax it, it feels different and can feel weird for a short period of time, and then it feels normal again. It's a
Yeah, I don't have
strange
that happen
thing.
anymore. I think they're
Yeah.
just relaxed now.
Yeah. I think after a while, people get used to the relaxation procedure and it takes hold a bit longer and the effects last a bit longer.
Right. So how did you end up becoming a hypnotherapist?
Well, it's a long story, but I'll keep it short.
Well, we've got plenty of time.
Well, I went for some sessions of hypnotherapy in the early 90s. So 25 years ago, and I found it fascinating. I'd been involved in doing some meditation previous to that, and in my youth, I had in my teenage years, I'd been given some really interesting books by my father, Power of Positive Thinking and The Magic of Thinking Big and How to Win Friends and Influence People, all positive mental attitude books, and I was fascinated with the power of the mind. But I never knew really what career to go into, and I had jumped from one career to another. And then I went for a couple, as I said, a couple of sessions of hypnotherapy, and it just blew my mind. It really did. And within 3 or 4 months, I had found a training course, had almost given up my job, given back my car, my pension, et cetera, and had started full-time training. And within, I think, 6 months, I was starting to see clients. And that was 21, 22 years ago.
That sounds like such a huge change. I mean, I'd really like to learn more about that. What was your profession before?
Well, I worked in a lot of professions. I worked for an airline, I worked for some publishing companies, I was in finance for a number of years. Nothing hugely earth-shattering, nothing that was a passion for me, just really to pay the bills. But I found with hypnotherapy almost from day one of the training course, that I had just fallen into something that I absolutely loved, and it didn't seem like work. It didn't seem like studying. It didn't. It there was there really was no decision process about it. It just happened.
Was there any there? I know you say there wasn't any decision process about it, but was there any particular moment where you maybe felt something where you realized, oh, this isn't something that I feel with the previous jobs that I've had, and this is something that I really enjoy about doing hypnotherapy?
Yeah, it it just seemed to click for me. The other jobs were really just choices to earn money. They just seemed to be whoever would take me on as a job, I would do it until they get fed up with me or I get fed up with them. And it really was, I had always wanted to be self-employed, but I didn't know what to do. I needed to do something that was a real passion. Mm-hmm. And when the hypnotherapy started, it really even wasn't from a financial point of view. I really took a big backward step financially to start seeing clients.
Mm-hmm. And you were just kind of getting a sense of gratification that made you okay with the backwards financial step?
Sure. Yep. I will admit that at that point in my life, I was single with no children. I'd come out of a marriage in 91. And so it was relatively easy for me to do, relatively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you made a lot of changes then in just a couple of years, it sounds like.
Sure. Yes, it was a massive change. Massive change financially and career-wise, but no regrets. There's never been a minute that I've regretted it.
And do you remember the day or the moment that you decided that you were going to start taking the hypnotherapy courses?
Yes, I went for an interview with one of the lecturers at a university in Glasgow, and I went for an interview. They at that stage they were quite serious about interviews about who they were going to take on. And I went for an interview, and I think I ended up asking more questions than she asked me. Mm-hmm. And again, we hit it off, and it was that. I think that was the decision made. It was a 3-month wait, quite a financial outlay for the course. And I remember the first day, probably about coffee break, after 2 or 3 hours, and standing there thinking, "This is it. I know what I want to do for the rest of my life."
Wow. That sounds like a great feeling.
Yeah, it was a great feeling. And I think when you have something like that, it makes it difficult further along the line to make decisions because you don't get that absolute certainty. There was nothing that was going to stop me doing this. Nothing mm-hmm. at all.
Yeah, and you kind of felt like you didn't have anything to lose. Is that what you're saying about having something?
I think that when you get something that is so certain for you, that is so, that there really isn't a yes or no, it's just a definite, uh-huh. you know, it's just, let's just do it. This yeah. seems so perfect. And every cell of my body was saying, let's just do this. And it you know, as I say, it worked out well. On the I think it was the first weekend of the course, there was 36 people attending. And one of the lecturers said, on average, there will be probably 3 of you that will go on to make this a full-time career. And I think at that stage, I thought that that's it. This is what I want to do. I will be one of that small percentage.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked out about right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But 3 or 4 people went on and are still working after 25 years.
Oh, wow. So that feeling of, you say, every cell in my body was just kind of like, yes, this is definitely something I want to do. Is that a feeling that you had ever had before about anything?
Probably not. Not to that extent. Not certainly not from a career point of view.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, almost definitely not.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was so certain for me. There's been a couple of times since then with different therapies that it has felt right for me to do it. It's been a tough lesson to learn. I have gone down a few routes and I've sort of struggled, you know, should I learn this? Should I follow this path? And it's taken me a number of years to realize if I struggle against it, it's not right for me.
Mm-hmm.
I used to think it was ego or fear or worries or concerns, but it certainly, from a therapeutic point of view, if it doesn't feel right to me, I simply don't do it now.
Mm-hmm. Do you kind of try to recall that that moment of that coffee break when you are making one of these decisions? Do you channel that moment or?
No, I can't say that I do. It's just, I guess it's an unconscious process but you have to go through that bit of a struggle before you realize this is the way to do it. You know, this is the decision, either yes or no. And if it feels right, I go and do it.
So when you went to that interview and you found that you were asking more questions than the interviewer, was that something that that you sort of sprung into attention and realized and noticed and took note of? Or
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a very different process from a job interview. Mm-hmm. I just had a list of questions that just came to mind, and it got to the stage she had to say to me, okay, time's up. No, ask, if you decide to come on this course and we decide to accept you, then you'll have 18 months to ask all these questions.
Yeah.
So it was, it was quite funny when I think back.
What do you have any hypotheses about what it was about hypnotherapy, what the different aspects were? Was it working with people? Was it helping people? What were the things do you think, the elements that you think attracted you to it?
I think it was, actually seeing how, on one hand, how gentle the procedure is, and yet how powerful it could be, helping people achieve what they want to achieve. Mm-hmm. Certainly the first morning was blowing apart the myths of hypnosis. And that is something that I have to explain to almost every client that I see. There are so many myths about hypnosis and what it can and what it can't mm-hmm. do that... I mean, I remember in the early parts of my career going to see my bank manager, and he wouldn't look me in the eye. When he found out I was a hypnotherapist, he wouldn't look me in the eye. I suspect for fear that I would suddenly put him in a trance and rob the bank, in his mind. But, there are many people that believe the Hollywood version of hypnosis, which, of course, is ridiculous.
Well, yeah, let's get into that. I have to admit that before we were using the Relax app, I had seen hypnosis done at like a party or something like that, where I don't know what to call the type of person who does
just
that.
Just hypnosis, yes.
I'd seen hypnosis and actually, so I used the Relax app and I didn't, I guess I didn't even realize that you were a hypnotherapist. And then I remember I was studying something else recently. It was a book about a researcher who researched, just to be particular, he researches loneliness. And they had a study where they hypnotized certain participants to be in a lonely state of mind. Mm-hmm. And then that caused other things that they had hypothesized. And this was, so it was the first time I had like looked at a legitimate study and been like, oh, wow, hypnosis is a real thing, which I think is actually kind of ignorant now that I've actually looked at some of the research and such. So
sure.
Can you help us dispel some of the myths for any people who might have skepticism?
This is my take on it with certainly what I would call stage hypnosis. When you go to see a stage hypnosis show, the majority of people know what they're going along to see. And the skill of a stage hypnotist is, well, they are very skilled people, but a lot of the skill is in the selection of the people to come up on stage. Stage hypnosis uses a very quick form of hypnosis, quite authoritarian. But the quicker the form, the less people it works for. And so when people go to a show and know what they are in for, and then they do what's called the suggestibility test, which mm-hmm. generally is the hypnotist will ask the audience to clasp their hands together and will describe the hands getting tighter and tighter. Now, some people won't do it, and some people will do it, find that their hands are getting tighter and pull their hands apart. And some people will just go with it, and their hands will get tighter and tighter to the degree that they may not be able to pull them apart. That test shows one thing, imagination. That's it. It's just imagination. At that stage, the hypnotist will ask the people who can't get their hands apart to come on stage, at which point many of the people find the strength to pull their hands apart. But some people will then volunteer to go on stage. And out of that selection, the hypnotist will then choose four or five or six and perhaps the star of the show. But ultimately, when you break it right down, a stage hypnotist, no matter what he or she says they're doing, has no power over the person on stage, i.e. the person on stage will not cross a moral boundary, and they will not, how can I put this? They will not do things that they really unconsciously don't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if someone doesn't want to lose weight, a stage hypnotist can't make them lose weight. Believe you me, if they could make people lose weight, they wouldn't be doing stage hypnosis. They'd be the richest people in the world,
mm-hmm.
just right. about. So on the other end of the spectrum is hypnotherapy, where we have to use techniques that are very slow and very gentle and very easy, so that most people can then go down into, in hypnosis we would call trance, but equally you could call it deep relaxation or mindfulness or meditation. It's the same physical state.
Mm-hmm.
So when I have individuals coming in to see me, not only are many of them suffering from stress or panic attacks or anxiety, but then they have an additional level of stress or anxiety because they're coming to see a hypnotherapist. They don't know what to expect. Most folk come in the door a little bit wary, a little bit unsure, and go out the door an hour later having loved the experience, because it may be the first time in years or decades that they've actually relaxed.
So when you say that, yeah, if somebody doesn't want to do a certain thing, that you won't be able to hypnotize them, or you said a stage hypnosis person wouldn't be able to get them to do something they don't want to do. Does that apply to people who, you know, come in and their spouse wants them to quit smoking, but they don't really want to quit smoking? Or
yep.
Does that
apply? You really have to want to change. Now, in actual fact, that is the majority of people that come along to see me, but occasionally, very occasionally, you will get someone in the instance of smoking who has been nagged into doing it by their husband or their wife.
Mm-hmm.
They come along, we have a session of hypnosis. They go out the door and light up a cigarette and say to their spouse, "See, I told you it wouldn't work."
Yeah.
and they've paid their fee, and that's them, you know, now convinced that nothing will stop them.
That immediately makes me think, gosh, that would make it a hard thing to research, because, you know, the placebo effect being such a powerful thing,
sure.
it depends upon somebody wanting to be able to on somebody believing that it's going to work.
Oh, yes. I think the thing is that, you see, on one hand, people need to want to stop, but on the other hand, there are many people who have come along to see me who perhaps have tried and failed 20 times. And even in the case of smoking, they've seen family members become ill through smoking and pass away. And even that hasn't been enough to stop them. So what we're dealing with when smoking is not necessarily the drug addiction. It's more the habitual and emotional behavior linked with smoking. And hypnotherapy is absolutely wonderful at breaking those long-established habits and the emotional links to the smoking.
Is that the majority of the sessions, or is it the majority of what you're treating, or what's the general gamut?
It used to be. In fact, many hypnotherapists specialize in stopping smoking because smokers are your best adverts. A smoker will be quite, if they stop, is quite happy to be in the bar or in the pub, and someone says, "Have you stopped smoking?" And they say, "Yes, and I've done it with this method." So they're very happy to talk about it, unlike much more private topics, as you can imagine, where people simply don't want to talk about issues. But I have to say that over the last 20 years, the number of smokers has decreased rapidly because of better education and because of the smoking ban that came into place, I think, over here about 10 years ago. So no public places, no enclosed public spaces, people can't smoke. Big changes. I guess it's the same in the States.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think it's actually, I've recently bought a book about it because I'm just fascinated by the idea of it as a case where there is kind of a triumph against all odds, because there's so much money to be made in selling cigarettes and having people addicted to them, but somehow in the United States we've managed to reduce smoking a great deal, get some controls in place, and also change public opinions. I mean, good luck putting an online dating profile up and saying that you're a smoker. I mean, I can't speak from experience, but there's a stigma against smokers now.
It has changed out of all recognition in the last 10 years. So, on one hand, smoking has used to be the number one thing that most hypnotherapists would work on. On the other hand, in the last 20 years, there's been a much more of a recognition in the general public that they can use it for phobias and anxieties and pain control and sleeping and confidence and many other things.
And these are some of the things, like, I think a lot of people are less prone to say, "Oh, I have a problem with anxiety," than to say, "Oh, I want to quit smoking." That's
Sure.
becoming more acceptable, though.
It is becoming much more acceptable. There's a lot of people much more willing to talk about stress and anxiety and tension. And that's really only been in the last 2 or 3 years, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if people reach their breaking point, or if it's just become, mental health in general has just become a more acceptable topic. People are more open about depression, anxiety, and
Sure.
things like that. So
Yeah, more people are talking about it. There's no doubt.
yeah, I mean, and that reminds me that with your apps, there's not just the Relax app. There's something for just about everything. I think I remember seeing quit smoking,
Yep.
lose weight, confidence, reduce anxiety.
Yep,
I'm sure that I'm
we've got
missing dozens
lots.
of them.
I think we've got about high 20s at the moment in
Wow.
subjects. Yeah. Very general ones, of course, but things like confidence and positivity and sleep. The deep sleep recording is by far the best seller. But of course, all the apps can be configured to a sleep ending, so many people do fall asleep with them, no matter what the subject matter.
Yeah. Can you tell us about how you got involved with, you were doing hypnotherapy, and then now you have this app empire, which it seems from the outside is doing very well.
We were very lucky, yes. Well, I had, when you're a hypnotherapist, you tend to have recordings that you give away to one-to-one clients. Showing my age now, I used to give away cassettes to clients, and they
For
would
the
be very
listeners who don't know what that is, there's like this, it's like tape, it's like literally tape, and it's two reels, and it would go in a machine, and that was had the audio on it. It was like,
Yeah.
yeah.
Oh, it's ancient technology. Ancient. However, Very quickly, when computers started getting, or you could buy burnable CD drives, I would start to put the audio onto the CD drives, and I guess I had 3 or 4 titles. That was it. And I was, at the same time as I'd started my career, I had got some good advice about... I had asked a lecturer, one of the lecturers, what was the best thing that he had done in his career. And he said, volunteer for a charity. Do a half a day with a charity. And when I started my career, I volunteered for a cancer support centre, and I started seeing individuals there and then groups. And that led to a request from the groups to record a good, long relaxation session that they could use at home. And so my first professional CD was done at that point. And as time went on and technology changed, I went into MP3s and built an e-commerce store. And it was ticking away. I mean, it really was slow, really slow. I didn't have the expertise or the search engine optimization or indeed the budget to sort of promote these 4 recordings. But the response to the recordings was hugely positive from anyone that had bought them. And when Steve Jobs announced the iPhone, I was lucky enough to get them. I got a few iPhones before they came into the UK, and I loved them, and I thought, this is fantastic. And then he announced the App Store, and I thought, oh, this is interesting. I wonder if I could make an app out of my relax recording and the stop smoking recording. And the App Store opened, and it was open about 3 months, and I was asking everyone that I knew, can you code for apps? And no one could. And then out of the blue, I got an email from a lawyer in Seattle, a chap called Michael Schneider, who was a big fan of the Deep Sleep CD, and he had written the first app for the iPhone that produced a landscape keyboard. You may remember, I don't know if you remember the first iPhone, the keyboard wouldn't turn to landscape when you turned the phone. So he had written an app for that, had been quite successful. And he wrote to me and said, I love your Deep Sleep app. We've been using it here in Seattle for a number of years. Your Deep Sleep CD, rather. We've been using it here for a number of years. Do you think it would work as an app? And, of course, I wrote back, said, yes, I think this is wonderful. We had a conversation. That led to us releasing one app, then two, then three. A year and a half later, we had a range of apps, and we hadn't even met. So I met him 2 years later. We met in New York. We shook hands and signed a contract. We hadn't even had a contract at that point. And off it went, almost stratospheric. It just really took off. Wow. And I devoted myself at that point almost full time to doing some social media and to recording more titles and to answering the questions I was starting to get from people who had bought the apps. And it built, and it really went wonderfully well.
I love that story, because I think that from the outside, somebody might look at it and at the Relax app and say, oh, it's just an app where somebody talks, but there's so many years of study and work that came behind just developing the material. And then you also already previously had a business where you were selling these audio recordings to people. And as soon as the iPhone came out, you were instantly, not only were you ahead of people in your country with it, you were instantly on top of this, trying to get an existing business to be in this new format. So it wasn't like somebody just came up with an idea of, oh, we can put a relaxation on an app. You had years of work behind this, and and things just sort of converged. All the dots kind of connected, and boom, there you go.
We would never have had the longevity had it not been for the excellent coding that Mike does in Seattle, and also the excellent content, even though I say it myself, I do here.
I'll say it.
But there is absolutely no doubt also that there is a third part to it, and that is longevity. There is no doubt that being early into the App Store helped us tremendously. Our continued success is a testament to the amount of people who enjoy the apps and talk about them to friends and family and colleagues.
Yeah, I got it. I heard about it from one of my readers who recommended it to me just in an email, and I just tried it on a whim, and it just, you know, blew my brain wide open. It was awesome. And I've since mentioned it on when Lifehacker did a How I Work feature. I mentioned it in there because it's something that I use very regularly. It's on the homepage of my iPhone because I kicked off Twitter and Facebook. They're on the iPhone. They're just not allowed on the homepage. I try to put the apps homepage, that are good for me. And actually, so then the number one, Deep Relax is what I have.
I'm flattered. That's really great.
The first one. Then there's Kindle and then Audible and you know, other apps that are good for me. Yeah. If I'm using it, I'm not wasting my time.
I'm hugely flattered that I'm in the same line as Kindle and Audible. They're wonderful, wonderful apps.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's important to see, it's inspiring to see businesses like this that I think do help people, because, you know, digital distraction and people's relationships with their digital devices is, you know, this might sound like a bit much, but it's bordering on the smoking thing in a way. People are
huge,
getting addicted to them, and there's a lot of money to be made from distracting people and taking away their focus and even in making them anxious. And it's a difficult problem to make a business where people will pay to do something that's good for them. And it seems like you've managed to make a business that does help people. And I think, I hope that it's a part of what I call like the behavioral revolution, that we have all this technology, sure, we have all this knowledge about ways to help people. But the economics are the hard part, is getting, you know, making viable businesses that use both of those things. So that's
sure. I agree totally. Technology is a huge issue. The addiction to technology. It's a huge issue. And there's a lot of people are finding that there are negative side effects to being connected all the time. There used to be in generations gone past, a time that people would be traveling to work or walking to work or doing manual jobs, and they wouldn't be connected to the internet, or they wouldn't be even listening to music. And in those minutes or hours that was happening, there would be unconscious processing going on, daydreaming or ruminating or thinking about things and just processing it. And that doesn't happen nowadays. People don't have the time to do that. They're continually connected. If you see two people in a coffee shop or in a bar or in a restaurant and one gets up to use the restroom, almost invariably the other person pulls out their phone.
Yeah, this is something I've personally tried to combat, is these moments when I might feel a tinge of anxiety to pull up my phone and check something, to just sit there and process it. Because I think that you're right. You're kind of, during these times, it's like running defrag on a computer in a way. It's like everything's getting reorganized, and all of the things that are not useful are getting discarded. Actually, we had a neuroscientist on the show previously who studies the nature of insight, and he was talking about how sleep is work, that when you're sleeping, that your brain is getting rid of not only neurotoxins, but it's also getting rid of information that is irrelevant. It's making connections between things that seem disparate. And that is what leads to creative thinking. That is what leads to insightful thinking. And that ties in to our conversation in a way, in that there's also, I don't remember her name, but there is a researcher, if somebody searches for the creativity crisis, who, based at least on one measurement of creativity, says that creativity is plummeting.
Yes.
And, you know, one of the culprits is technology. That's hard to prove, but that is, you know, that's all a part of this.
There is absolutely no doubt. There are so many stories over the centuries and the decades of Edison and Einstein and Henry Ford and all these people who have set themselves problems, and it is in a nap or a walk in the countryside or something that the solution pops in. And you can either say that that's coming from the unconscious, you know, the collective consciousness, or it's just this incredible biocomputer that we have in our head that is processing things when we're not getting bombarded with information. And creativity is lost when we are trying too hard to do something and bombarded with information.
Yeah, there's a book with a great collection of rituals and habits of great poets and thinkers and philosophers and scientists called Daily Rituals. And it's, you very consistently see a theme of relaxation or of taking time to do something that's kind of mindless. Just as a couple examples, Darwin walked for hours every day. Mm-hmm. Herman Melville, the author of Moby Dick, he loved to feed his cow a pumpkin and just loved to just watch the cow chew the pumpkin, just do this mindless thing. And he'd have somebody knock on his door every day at 2:30 p.m. to get him to stop working, regardless of how engrossed he was in what he was doing, because he knew that ultimately it was better for his creativity.
Sure. I think it is so important that we have rituals, and I'm in the midst of doing quite a few new recordings at the moment, so mm-hmm. I have to have my own rituals that stop me from either recording for too long, in which case I lose that sort of intimacy that mm-hmm. comes through. But I've also got to be very relaxed when I'm doing the recordings. So I have to do my own sort of therapy process before
I'd love to hear record. About that. How do you get yourself in the mode to be ready to record?
I have a home studio, and I wear the most ridiculous comfortable clothes. I have, even in bright sunlight, I have the curtains pulled. I have a candle on.
Candle, wow.
Yeah, it gives a different light.
It does.
Because I'm recording straight into a digital recorder with and there's all the screen and the blue light that comes from that. I have a hoodie with the hood pulled up. And I have a special chair that I sit in. Mm-hmm. And I make sure that I'm pretty relaxed. And over the years, there's been a number of occasions where I've set everything up and I've started recording and it hasn't been right. And I've gone away and sort of, well, not beat myself up about it, but grown concerned and worried that it's, you know, what's happening here that's just not right. And then I came to the realization that if it just doesn't feel right, I just don't do it. Again, it's one of these things that there's been times over the years. There was a time last year that I was up at 3 a.m. I woke up at 3 a.m. and thought, a good time to record. And I got up and did it for 2 hours. Not really a thought process behind it. It just felt right. Mm-hmm. So when it doesn't happen, I'm quite relaxed about it now. I'll go and do something else. take my mind off it, and then it just happens again, and I'll just start.
Well, you've kind of created some triggers for yourself of putting on these comfortable clothes, lighting that candle,
sure, it's just
getting into
habit.
That room, and putting in the hoodie is an interesting thing.
It's a sort of comfort and
like
warmth.
Putting blinders
thing.
On as well.
Yeah. It's just a comfortable. It's a funny sort of thing because when I see clients, I think many therapists will say the same thing, especially in the speaking therapies. When you see a client, you just switch off from absolutely everything else. You're just completely there in totality with them. And that hour seems like 5 minutes afterwards. And mm-hmm. and that's quite easy to do when you've got a human being sitting across from you. When you've got just a cold microphone and you've still got to create that intimacy. I like to think that when people listen to the apps, they feel as if it's a conversation. It's a it's just the two of us. I think that's one of the reasons that people really like them, and a lot of people have found it's been the only thing that's relaxed them. Of course, it's not for everyone, but I think the majority of people, there's been a lot of people. For instance, one of the deep relaxation CD that I did for the Cancer Support Center, I then started selling into the corporate world, and the HR department of the Metropolitan Police in London bought a whack of these CDs, and they said it was the first CD that the male officers had liked, because the rest were very, the previous relaxation CDs had been quite flowery and quite new agey and mm-hmm. things like that. Now, not that there's anything wrong with unicorns and rainbows and angels and crystals.
that creates resistance in some people.
It does.
It would create resistance in me, quite honestly.
Yeah, and I think I think when you're dealing with people with severe anxiety or stress to start with, when they are stress casualties, you've got to be so gentle and easy that it's almost not fooling them into relaxation, but it's so slow and so gentle that most folk don't realize they're relaxing until it gets about halfway through. Mm-hmm. And once you have what I would term as a convincer, once people realize that they've either A, feel relaxed and the tension, as you said, in your jaw has gone, or mm-hmm. the back pain has disappeared, or they're not eating as much or they're just sleeping better, they're then convinced. And that's a wonderful stage to get to when you know something is working for you. Mm-hmm. And as I say in a lot of the promotional material I send out, it's these apps, the recordings, no matter what format they're in, there's no calories and there's no chemicals and you can't get addicted to them. So there are no negative side effects. I always say to people, just practice the techniques on your own as well. Once you know the procedure, you can then practice the techniques and you can learn it yourself.
Yeah, you go through the, I don't know what it's called, kind of a body scan thing,
yep.
of relaxing from your feet on up to various parts of your body. I've tried that during meditation as well.
Yep.
I think it works a lot better when you're in my ear, but
well, absolutely. There's no doubt of that. That's progressive relaxation, and the thing is that when you're doing relaxation or meditation or mindfulness yourself, there still is a conscious process to follow. If mm-hmm. that makes sense, especially in the early days and weeks and months. Whereas when you listen to someone else guiding you through it, that conscious part of you switches off and you can allow it to happen. And therefore, even after 30 years of meditating on and off for myself, and I'm pretty much very skilled in self-hypnosis and mindfulness, there is something lovely about putting on someone else's recording and allowing it just to happen. and just losing yourself in it.
So you listen to other people's recordings sometimes.
I do a lot of research. It either gives me good ideas on what to add to my recordings, or I think, no, I'm pretty good. There's a lot of dreadful recordings out there.
Sure. Well, I think there's probably a lot of people who maybe don't have the credentials and experience and see what you've built, and they think that it's just an app with somebody talking in it, and that's...
Yeah, it's the funniest thing. There's a process that you go through over a number of years when you're seeing clients or you're doing classes that it becomes much more than the words. There is an intention behind the words, and I remember again one of my lecturers who I keep in touch with, and she was saying that what she noticed was that after about 5 or 6 years of private practice, people were coming in to see her, and in the process of doing the case study, they were going into hypnosis, they were going into relaxation and light trance. It's as if something's happening before the actual session.
Yeah.
It's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, there's a lot of details in it. I think I've even noticed details, I think, in your intonation or the rhythm of the way you might say things. Just as an example, like if you say just the way that you say it, that makes me go deeper into relaxation. Or when you say exhale and you pause for a moment, that is another thing that definitely triggers me into more relaxation. Those are intentional things that you've learned over the years, or
I guess they must be. And what one of the things that I've had to do is do recordings, and once they're done and edited, I don't listen to them again. Simply because I would listen and say, I wonder why I said that way.
Mm-hmm.
Or I wonder why I said it with that tone.
I can relate. I have a podcast, so.
Absolutely. So I think, my goodness. And if I listen back to my recordings and I listen to them and I think, my goodness, that's a funny way of saying that. And yet I've obviously said it like that, you know, throughout my career.
Well, I think, and it kind of goes back into this mood that you set for yourself, where it's you're kind of setting the proper mood that you would like for a person to consume your what you're creating in it.
Yeah.
So you're in there, you're connecting. I do a similar thing sometimes if I'm writing and it's a late night, like put on a certain type of music and like maybe I'll light a candle or put at least make the lighting soft and like really try to get myself in the mood that I would like for people to be in when they read something or see something that I've designed or whatever. And you can, that sort of, that's, it's like, it is like, oh gosh, what's the word? Anyway, it's like that travels through the work, the mood that you put yourself when you do the work travels through the work to the people who are consuming it.
I couldn't agree more, and I can't think of the right words either, but I understand exactly what you're saying. And that has made me think, actually, perhaps for the first time, that maybe by getting into the comfortable clothes and putting the hoodie up and being in the perfect chair and being in dim lighting, I'm setting up what I want the listener to be feeling like. That's interesting. Yes. If I'm relaxed, they're relaxed.
It's not even a complicated word. I just can't think of it right now. It's what Stephen King describes writing as, which is basically putting words into another person's brain from far away.
Yes.
It's a very simple word. I'm just not able to think of
it. It will come to you as soon as we finish this podcast.
Yeah, exactly. It will. You're right. Once I relax... and stop beating myself up for not not being able to figure out what the word is.
Let it go, David. Let it go. It will come to you.
Oh, wait, are you hypnotizing me now?
No, not at all.
So I'm going to get into some of the rapid fire questions as we wrap up here.
Sure. Well,
rapid fire is maybe an exaggeration. What's the biggest compromise that you've had to make to get where you are today?
Gosh, I don't know if I've had a compromise to get to where I am today. Certainly the biggest mistake I've made was with the App Store. I was doing a lot of corporate work, and I was seeing clients, and when the app started taking off, as I said, I stopped many things to do to build the social media side of things, and to perhaps naively think that I could influence the sales of the apps. And in actual fact, the App Store is its own little galaxy. It has its own rules. There's very little you can do to influence without huge budget. But and we've never spent any money on advertising or PR. And I think that my mistake in the early years of the App Store was not concentrating on other things and allowing the apps to grow. They would have anyway. However, the social media side of things has been a great learning curve, and I'm given that most people who use the apps are using them to go over some issue, I'm absolutely honoured and flattered that I've grown a relatively sizable audience of people who are quite happy to put up their hand and say, I use these.
Well, it sounds like it might have felt like a compromise that maybe you had to not take in some clients that you might have worked on one-on-one for the sake of creating this app and impacting probably millions of people.
Well, that's true, yes.
Yeah. I thought of the word. It's
perfect.
It's telepathy.
Telepathy, right.
So yeah, putting yourself in this mood creates telepathy in your work such that it hopefully transfers to those who are
consuming
it. I understand.
Okay. Yep.
That's what Stephen King describes writing as, which I thought was a brilliant passage in one of his books. When was a time that you put money on the table in exchange for something that you've valued? Left money on the table. I don't know if I said put or left.
What do you mean exactly by that?
Like maybe a situation comes up where you feel like you're not, well, I think I already know the answer because you kind of already said it earlier, but where you have to turn down an opportunity to make money right now because there's something,
oh, I see.
Some other force working on you that, a thing that you value that makes you.
Yeah. Certainly the corporate side of things. Not necessarily because of the finances, just the time involved. I was getting some work down south in London, and I was, you know, doing a one-day course was actually taking 3 days, a day either side to travel. And it really takes it out. You're doing these courses. So I did pull back from doing a lot of the corporate work, and I'm, there's a part of me that wants to start that up again because I really miss it. I still see some clients, but I miss the interaction with groups.
Sorry to interrupt, but is that kind of where you go visit a corporation to help
or a charity? Yeah,
to their group. Yeah,
yeah, and I'll go in and do a day's training with them, and I'll teach them. I'll teach them deep relaxation techniques. I'll show them how to do it. I'll get them to a stage where they know that they're doing it. I'll get them to a stage where they know why they're doing it, and then I teach them techniques that, in that relaxed state, where they can go with it. So we demonstrate goal setting and visualization and again things like creativity, and showing. Certainly, in the corporate world, you don't want to talk about relaxation too much because many people still think that relaxation is stopping people being productive. And in actual fact, it really makes people productive.
I mean, I think that today especially, it's kind of the exact opposite, is that just because you can type really fast doesn't mean that you're going to be able to do meaningful work, especially in the day of the knowledge worker, where the quality of your output is rated by your ability to take disparate pieces of information and process all of it and come up with an insightful solution in many cases. So yeah, it can really be counterintuitive that
sure
relaxing is ultimately going to help you.
Yes.
So do you have to brand things differently when you deal with the corporations then?
I used to. Quite a time ago, 15 years ago, the thought of a hypnotherapist coming in, or even going in and teaching meditation or mindfulness, or all three, was almost frowned upon. But my goodness, there's been big changes in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, I did. For the corporate work, 10 years ago or so, I did rebrand. But it was one of these things that felt a little alien to me, that I was going in as an individual but under this corporate banner. The website that was created was all written in corporate speak, in the way that, you know, we believe that HR managers or decision makers would make the decision. But it really has changed now, primarily because of mindfulness and the massive uptake in mindfulness in the corporate world.
I mean, attitudes have changed so much,
hugely
culturally. It's fascinating to have, you know, been alive long enough to actually see something like that in process.
Absolutely,
and I think attitudes can change.
Yes, and I think it's perhaps and I've got my own theories behind it. Mindfulness is magnificent, and it can be life enhancing and life changing. But I also believe it's been accepted rapidly, because it doesn't have the same baggage as meditation does, or stress management, or indeed hypnotherapy, where they all have a certain baggage that comes along with them. Whereas mindfulness is almost baggage free. It's beautifully simplistic. So it's been accepted much quicker.
And it describes itself with its word in a way that the very meaning of it is kind of hard to object.
Correct.
It's mindful. Like, it's hard to object to being mindful.
Yes. And I think one of the issues is that very much like many other things in the last 10 or 15 years, because it's been had a rapid growth, there's been so many folk jumping on the bandwagon, and they're doing it a disservice, because they don't have the background in it. It's a wonderful thing to see that there are so many people talking about it and practicing.
What's the last book that you read that changed the way that you saw something?
The last book that I read was Michael Neal's book called Inside Out, which is a magnificent book about changing the way you think about the world and seeing things differently.
Considering it was intended to make you change the way you see something. Yeah.
Absolutely. It's been a long time. It's been a long time since I've read any fiction books. I was a huge consumer of Stephen King books. The Stand and It are two of my all-time favorite books. But lately, I've just been reading self-help books and books about meditation, which I just find fascinating anyway. So,
endlessly fascinating for you, considering that it's been your profession for 25 years or so.
It's a growing field, and it's an expanding field, and there's always something new to find out.
And the people who are listening to this podcast are generally trying to help them find a way to carve out their own definition of success. And I think that's why, one of the reasons why I have you on the podcast. Of course, I love your app and I think relaxation is important as well. But do you have a final message for such listeners?
Follow your bliss. Take some time for yourself. do what feels right. And these are all ridiculously simple statements, but I'm not really a philosopher. I realize how lucky I am doing what I do for a living and loving every moment of it. It's not been without its challenges, but it certainly makes you see life in a very different way that can seem strange to other people. I would say that the best thing you can do is take some time, no matter what method you use, take some time to get into stillness. I would say that if you're going to read any book or listen to any self-help audiobooks, I would recommend Eckhart Tolle and The Power of Now, about getting into the moment. It is hugely powerful. And of course, the Andrew Johnson apps are magnificent as well. But
I agree.
Eckhart Tolle has been an amazing thing for me to listen to.
Yeah.
So taking some time to get into the moment, whether it's in meditation, relaxation, self-hypnosis, mindfulness, or simply just daydreaming, it's wonderful.
And where can people get more of Andrew Johnson and connect
with him? I guess if you put my name into Google, you'll find all the links. Of course, I'm unlucky enough to have the same name as that disgraced American president. So I think he was, Andrew Johnson was impeached. So there's him and there's an English Premiership footballer called Andrew Johnson. And the three of us have a little ongoing Google battle for the top of Google and our name. But if Andrew Johnson, Johnson, into Google, you'll find me in the top one or two. And from there, you will see the links to my website, which has got the MP3s and links to the apps, and also the links to social media, iTunes, Google Play, and Amazon, which have all the apps. That's probably the easiest way.
Great. And I'll have all that in the show notes. I'll have your website in there. Perfect. I'll have the Twitter. And also, I set up a special URL. If people go to katavi.net/relax, that will take them straight to the Relax app, either the Relax app or the Deep Relax app. I'm not precisely sure. On the iOS app store, at least.
Sure.
And I believe we have Android as well.
Yeah, and we don't have as many on Android as we do on iOS, but that's changing later on this year. There are two completely free apps, Relax Light and Power Map, which have proven to be very popular. And they're little taster sessions that people can listen to and get used to the process. And then if they like the accent, if you like the pacing and the pronunciation, and if you like the background music, then there's plenty more.
Yeah, I love all of those things. So it's been an honor having you on the podcast. Thank you so much.
Thanks, David. It's been fantastic.
So there we have it. Before I go, I gotta ask, do you like books? If you do, I'd love to send you my book recommendations. About 90% of them will be nonfiction on subjects spanning from biographies to neuroscience. Just go to katavi.net/reading, sign up, and you'll get my first set of recommendations right away. You'll be supporting the show if you buy any of those books through the links in the email. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Katavi. The theme music for this show is See In You, performed by The Album Leaf, courtesy of Sub Pop Records. Love Your Work is a production of Katavi, Inc.